The first company presentation today is from ProAssurance, who has participated in this insurance conference for many of the years. In fact, we were talking about it last night over dinner, and Stan's predecessor, Dr. Daryl Crow, used to take himself from the podium and actually walk through the crowd and give his presentation. It was one of the more fascinating experiences that we used to associate ourselves with when listening to the ProAssurance story. Anyways, ProAssurance, as many of you know, is a leading writer of professional liability insurance. Frankly, in our opinion, it's the bellwether publicly traded specialty insurance company out there that's doing medical malpractice. If you would have bought the company stock last year after its presentation at this conference, you would have generated a 20% plus return, which is quite handsome. Today for management, we have Frank O'Neill, who runs the investor relations effort. We have Ned Rand, who's the chief financial officer, and certainly last but not least, Stan Sardins, who's the chairman and CEO. So let me turn it over to Stan.
Thank you, Greg. Good morning. Thank you, each of you, for being here. We appreciate the opportunity of sharing a few minutes of your time with you. But to those that don't know our company, I might spend just a second giving you a little background on the company, and I begin with this caveat. We hadn't released fourth quarter or year-end numbers, so to the extent we're talking about numbers at all today, we're talking about third quarter numbers. As Greg mentioned, we're a specialty writer of professional liability insurance, primarily medical professional liability insurance. You see on the slides before you our book value growth since we went public in 1991, and we're proud of that. We think that book value is the best intrinsic indicator of the value of a company such as ours. We have an equity of $1.8 billion. The annual compound growth rate of our book value since 1991 is 16%, and the compound annual growth rate of our stock price since inception is 14%. We write medical professional liability of one type or another throughout the United States. You'll see to the map there the various offices we have around the country, and that's important to us because this is a very, very local business. If you write this business in 50 states, you're in 50 different businesses. States which are contiguous to each other, say Alabama and Florida, for example, with respect to medical professional liability, they might as well be on different planets. Those businesses are so different. And that's replicated throughout the country. So you literally have to treat each state as a separate business, and therefore we think our geographic locations throughout the United States give us a very unique footprint and a very unique part of our business model. You see our top states there on the other slide, and you see our breakdown of the medical professional liability premium and other premium. We write a few attorneys. We write 84% of our business is physicians and dentists. We write a bit of ancillary health care, hospitals and facilities. We write about 40% of our business direct, and about 60% is distributed through independent agencies. We spread our risk across a broad geographic region, and we spread our risk throughout a number of specialties of physicians. We have about 63,000 policyholders. And we think that, too, gives us a good bit of diversity. As I mentioned, our year-end results will be released on February 23. And so today I'd like to concentrate just a minute rather on the numbers to talk to you a bit about recent M&A activity, a bit about the medical legal environment, the overall business climate, a few of our business initiatives, and long-term performance. All of this information is filed in an 8K, which was filed this morning. We are a company, as many of you know, that's a product of a number of mergers and acquisitions, probably 20 since 1991, the most recent of which was closed on November the 30th, was the acquisition of American Physician Services Group, which is located in Texas, writing business in Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. We anticipate adding around $60 million of Texas premium, which will make us the second largest writer of NPL in the state of Texas. We'll pick up a bit in Oklahoma and a bit in Arkansas. We already write some in all three of those states. So as you see, when you add that premium to the 2009 premium, you're looking at premium, direct written premium, of about $620 million. The integration of AMPH is going well. They will become our Austin office with a number of employees in Austin, and we anticipate that that will be quite a good acquisition for ProAssurance. We look at a lot of different things. We walk away from far more than we show any interest in. We'll prefer healthcare-centric activities, but we look at related liability lines. We've acquired a small company in Georgia a few years ago that writes only attorney professional liability, and we'll look for opportunities as they come. Though, as I say, we tend to be a very healthcare-centric organization. Let's talk for a moment about tort reform. As many of you know, and first of all, you have to be very careful when you use a phrase like tort reform, because it means different things to different people. If we were to convene a meeting of the American Trial Lawyers Association, they change their name occasionally, and they're now called the American Society for Justice or some such thing. But if we had a meeting of that group, they would tell you they're in favor of tort reform. They're all for it. But the tort reform they have in mind is very different from the tort reform that you and I have in mind. I mean, you can label something anything you want. As they say in Alabama, you can call a pig a beagle, but it won't hunt rabbits. So be careful what the label is that you put on something. There is no meaningful tort reform in the Health Care Reform Act. If there were, you'd hear a lot of talk about it. There was a recent indication by the president that he was willing to work with Republicans on tort reform. But again, be careful. It's easy to say that, but what does it really mean? And there's some things that get lopped into the category tort reform, which I would suggest to you are not meaningful tort reform. So if you hear such things as pre-suit affidavits, or medical review panels, or those sorts of things, be very wary about what they really represent, because too frequently they're simply a way at little cost for a plaintiff's lawyer to get an opinion about what his case may or may not be worth. What we do know about the Health Care Reform Act that was passed is that it's going to produce simply staggering changes in the American health care system. We don't have the collective imagination in this room to predict what all the effects of it are going to be. But we know we're going to add about 30 million people to the primary insured rolls, and we're not going to add a single physician. Now think about the implications of that. Think about the implications of that for yourself. Think about how much longer you're going to wait to see a physician. Think about how much longer you're going to wait for a surgical procedure. Economics will no longer be any barrier for care. And they hadn't been a great barrier in the past, but now everyone is going to have access, as the bill is implemented, to primary care at the same level everybody in the past that was insured had access to primary care. The two drivers, in my view, and this is not something you'll hear the actuaries talk about, but the two drivers of medical professional liability litigation are patient frustration and unexpected outcomes. One of those two things is generally what send a patient to a lawyer. Now stop and think for a moment and see if you can figure out anything that the Health Care Act is going to do to reduce patient frustration or to eliminate unexpected outcomes. I would suggest to you that it's going to increase both of those things. Because people that have regular health care, their expectations for that health care goes up, in spite of the fact that we all someday are likely to suffer, if not an unexpected outcome, an unwanted outcome. In fact, we all are certain to suffer it someday. There's nothing about adding 30 million new patients and not a single physician that's going to dampen patient frustration. It's going to heighten patient frustration. So my own view of the world, which does not have a bit of actuarial science behind it, is that the Health Care Reform Act is going to cause frequency in medical professional liability cases to go up, not to come down. That has an impact on everybody that writes this business. It particularly has an impact on the way claims have to be handled. And if you are an organization that settles claims, frequency is likely to go up for you more than if you're an organization that defends claims. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But we think the environment that's coming over the next few years will give our organization significant advantages with respect to the customers we insure. Up to this point, tort reform has been primarily a state-by-state activity, and different states have passed different types of tort reform. One of the reasons we are pleased to be in Texas is that Texas has constitutional tort reform. That is, to circumvent the possibilities of a state court declaring tort reform violative of the provisions of a state constitution, Texas embedded the tort reform in its state constitution. So it's part of that constitution and therefore can't be violative of the constitution. No other state, to my knowledge, has done that. Otherwise, it's been done through legislation amending or adopting a statute on the books of the different states. And different states have reacted differently to that tort reform. Some have accepted it, that is, the Supreme Courts of the various states have accepted it. Some have rejected it. Last year, Illinois rejected that state's statutory tort reform and set it aside. Missouri rejected at least part of its. Georgia rejected at least part of its tort reform. The plaintiff's lawyers do a very effective job of representing their clients, and one thing they are is persistent, and they come back over and over and over again. Business tends to focus on an issue, do something that they think rectifies the issue, and then walk away from it. The trial lawyers are very vigilant and very persistent in protecting what they think are important things for their clients. So the story on state statutory tort reform is a bit of a mixed bag with a bit of mixed results, and it's a state-by-state thing, which again emphasizes the importance of recognizing that every state is a very different business. Our reaction to state tort reform is to recognize it when it is declared constitutional, and therefore we know it will have a permanent impact. But until it's declared constitutional and shows up in the numbers, we don't give it effect in our reserves, because to us that just doesn't make a lot of sense until we know the outcome of it. Claims trends in MPL remains favorable. You'll see that industry-wide, for ProAssurance on that slide, our claims have fallen from 6,500 claims to 3,800 at the end of 2009. And we continue to try, as a percentage of the inventory, a huge number of cases. I know of no other company that will tell you how many cases they tried in 2009 around the country. But we are very transparent in that and tell you exactly how many cases we tried. And I think if anybody was trying any more, they'd probably tell you about it. But I'm telling you how many we try. And that's a lot of verdicts being returned in courtrooms all over this country on almost a weekly basis. But that's one of the things we offer our insurers, one of the important things that, in my view, serves to distinguish and differentiate us from other products. Life teaches us, all of life, that you generally get what you pay for. And if you pay a certain amount, that's likely to get you a policy that will result in a settlement of the case. If you pay another amount so that the carrier can take the risk and the exposure to the expense of defending the case, that will get you a different product. And if you look at the ProAssurance record here compared to the industry, you'll see that the industry settles almost twice as many cases as we do. You'll see that about 67% of all the claims filed get dropped. Those are sort of the gimmies. They go away. They either end on summary judgment, the plaintiff quits, the plaintiff runs out of money, prosecute the case, whatever the reason may be, those those are the easy ones. It's what happens in the other 32-33% of the cases that occur. And as you'll see, the fact that we try a lot more cases than anybody else is borne out in those statistics. Ohio gives us a laboratory for drilling down on that number even more, because Ohio requires the statutory data to be filed in such a way that we're able to mine the results. And as you'll see, we close more of our cases with no indemnity. We close fewer of our cases with no indemnity payment than anyone else. We close 93% of our cases with no indemnity payment. Others close 75%. We pay indemnity in fewer of our cases. Others settling almost or paying indemnity in over three times as many cases that we do. We close with the trial 13% of our cases in Ohio. Others close only 4% with the trial. So our product offers a chance of vindication, a successful defense, on a much more frequent basis than does the product of others. Now, of course, we pay a lot for that, as you'll see in terms if you look at the legal fees and all. But what we get for that is a lower indemnity dollar payout there at the bottom of the chart. You'll see that our average indemnity payment per claim file, closed file, is $27,700 versus others, which is $70,000. Now, what does that do for the insured? What it does for the insurers is mean that if they take their case to trial and win it, there's no data bank payment. 17 states require the results of these lawsuits to be posted online. That may not seem like a big deal to you, but it is a big deal to the physician. Because when Mrs. Smith is referred to Dr. Jones and she goes online and sees that Dr. Jones has settled three cases, what does she do? She looks for another physician. Because she thinks, as do most people, that if Dr. Jones has settled three cases, he must have done something wrong three times. People don't settle cases if they didn't do anything wrong. That's the impact that has on a physician, and we work very hard to prevent our insureds from being unfairly sought out as targets in these lawsuits. We have a high retention rate across the landscape. You'll see it's hovered around 90% since 2001, and the third quarter of 2010 was 89%. The combined ratio, which is another key metric, as you know, in our industry, our average since 1991 has been 95.3%. The industry average has been 108.8%, and as you know, obviously lower is better. The world of physicians and their practice is changing. It's changing not only because of the health care reform, but for other reasons as well. Here's a number to think about in terms of the implication. The New York Times reported last year that over 50% of the physicians in the United States are now employed by hospitals or hospital-related organizations. Think about what that means. Think about what that means to somebody buying our product. The old, when I started practicing law in the early 70s, that number was probably closer to 5%. And now it's up over 50% and it's growing. What's driving that? Physician demographics drive it. Physicians today tend to be less entrepreneurial. They want more structured times. They want more predictable time. They don't want to leave the house at 5:30 and not have a clue whether they're going to be home at 7:30 or 10:30. They want to know the hours they have to work. The regulatory burden on a practicing physician is growing by the day in terms of electronic medical records, in terms of reimbursement requirements, all those things. It's not easy to practice medicine. And then the whole notion of the Health Care Act and the uncertainty that it presents to physicians tends to drive them into hospitals. So we think this presents a unique opportunity for us, and that unique opportunity is represented in our recent initiative with Ascension Health Center. Ascension, as you may know, is the largest Catholic health organization in the United States. And we began a pilot product in Michigan where we will jointly insure physicians who are affiliated, not as employees, but on the staff of the Ascension hospitals throughout Michigan. And we have the opportunity to spread that program throughout the United States. And we think it's programs like that with hospitals that we have a unique opportunity to involve ourselves in because we have the balance sheet, we have the experience, we've insured hospitals for over 25 years, and we have the geographic spread that enables us to do that. Another product that we've developed is a product called ProControl, which takes the traditional insurance product and changes it in the sense that the hospital has a bigger stake in either a self-insured retention or a deductible and more say-so about the ultimate outcome of the lawsuit. It's a unique product which we have developed and offered on the market now for a little over a year. I'm getting signals that my time is about up, but I'll be delighted to take questions should anyone have any. Yes, sir.
Good morning. I'm wondering how the prevalence of electronic medical records will, or if it will, change your approach to defending claims, or your strategy for settling and dealing with claims.
Yeah, the question is whether the advent of electronic medical records will affect our claims strategy. You know, the electronic medical records sound great. You know, if you it just sounds good, doesn't it? To know everything about everybody, you're going to be able to push a button and do it. Well, it's not so great. It may be great someday when it's fully implemented and fully understood, but it presents risk to physicians now. A lot of these electronic medical record programs are geared so that there's a default to something, and if you're not careful, it gets defaulted. So you have a patient that is deceased, and the medical record defaults to he left the hospital improved. And so there are lots of things like that that have to be worked through. And physicians, it takes a lot of time. It's tedious to do the electronic medical records. It's coming, and the government is going to incentivize it by offering payments and all sorts of things. But what we can't permit to happen, either in the practice of medicine or the defense of the practice of medicine, is for physicians' judgment and individual assessment to be diluted in fact or by the records. Because it's that individual skill and judgment that makes the physician who he is or who she is. And if we didn't have that, then I could just go to the medical library for my health care. But I need the knowledge that's in that medical library to be applied through the use of judgment. And a handwritten record sometimes can best document the dilemma that the physician faces. You know, when a patient walks in the door, there are literally thousands of things that can be the diagnosis. Now, in hindsight, it all looks perfectly easy. It was crystal clear. But unfortunately, he didn't have that hindsight. He had to look at it straightforward. Now, he's subject to being second-guessed, and she will be second-guessed if the patient has a bad outcome or if her patient doesn't do what was expected. So medical records sound great. Maybe someday they will be great. If they obscure individualized judgment on the part of the physicians that the physician brought to bear in the treatment of the patient, then they will present an obstacle to us, and we've got to learn to deal with that, and physicians have to learn to deal with that. So it's not a panacea. Yes, sir.
Physicians are all humans, and of course, they're not all created equal. I'm wondering if there have been any regulatory or technology changes that have allowed either your company or your industry to improve underwriting and better price your product, tailor it to each individual physician for their capabilities or lack thereof.
Yeah, the underwriting remains very much at the core of what we do, and in our basic legacy physician business, we don't permit anyone else to hold the pen. We underwrite it all internally within one of these local offices we have around the country. Now, there's been a lot of suggestions over the years that somehow you can take technology and build a map of what a quote good, whatever that means, physician looks like versus a bad physician looks like. What happens with those maps, and they got lots of different names for them, is they tend to get overwhelmed by the realities and the vagaries of the insurance market, so that the market tends to push you one way or the other. We think there is no substitute for individual underwriting. We think there's no substitute for pricing a risk appropriately. We think there's no substitute for being able to walk away from a risk and being willing to walk away from a risk if you can't price it adequately. But is there some technological means whereby we can sort of figure out instantaneously who the good risks are and who the bad risks are? The answer to that is no. The best indicator you have is what their experience has been. And that's another reason that it's important to physicians to try and defend those cases where they didn't do anything wrong. You know, when an insurance company settles its a case, the insurance company gets to close its file. The physician never will close her file. It'll be open the rest of her life. Every time she fills out an application for staff privileges, every time she fills out a credentialing issue, every time she applies for professional liability coverage, she'll have to disclose that. And that experience has consequences to it in terms of the underwriting you're talking about. But there's no magic bullet from a technological standpoint. Back in the 70s, fetal heart rate monitoring became available. And there was a thought back then that if we could monitor the heart rate of the fetus and follow its patterns, and a fetus got in trouble, we could quickly deliver the fetus and we would eliminate cerebral palsy. And that's a shorthand description of what the hope was with fetal heart monitoring. And now I think most obstetrical experts will tell you it didn't have that effect at all, because a huge amount of cerebral palsy occurs because of something going on in the first or second trimester and has nothing to do with neonatal events. So it looked like fetal heart monitoring would become standard of care, but they've decided that and most people use it because it's easier to use than having the nurse auscultate the heart rate on a regular basis. But there are no magic bullets, and there is no substitute in defending these cases for a physician bringing individual judgment to bear. She will be wrong because it's a human endeavor, and none of us are capable of perfection. And that's never the issue in a malpractice case, whether it was a mistake. If you and I didn't make mistakes, we'd quit putting erasers on the end of pencils. Yes, sir.
Hi, good morning. Thanks. The competition with mutuals is pretty much well known in the industry.
Right.
And with St. Paul leaving the market as kind of the last major carrier back in the day that displaced a large group and obviously created an opportunity. And just wondering if going forward, if y'all are expecting increased competition from some of the larger carriers or whether you expect the landscape changes from that aspect.
The question, you heard the question, because of the microphone. You know, you get predictions every year the commercial carriers are going to come back into the market. And they are in the market at the big hospital level, and even probably to some extent at the huge mega group physician level, 1,000 physicians. But thus far, they've not displayed any real interest in coming into the space we occupy. Now, they certainly could. But you've got to remember that this is a heavy-touch insurance business. It's a heavy touch from an underwriting standpoint. It's a heavy touch from a claim standpoint. It's a lot of work to do what we do. And it takes specialized expertise to do what we do, and I think that's what makes us successful in it. And thus far, the commercial carriers have not come back in the market. We've been in a period of profitability the last several years. But even looking at that period of profitability, our area of the business, the MPL area, is historically the most volatile business there is in the property and casualty field. Last question. Who?
I was just actually wondering whether the various groups in Washington involved with health care reform are talking to parties such as yourselves, you know, to get input as to how to go forward.
There is a group, the PIAA, which is the Physicians Insurer Association of America, which was all the sort of historical bedpan mutuals, and that group is active in the discussions in Washington as to what tort reform ought to look like. Bear in mind that even in, say, 2002, when the Republicans controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House, tort reform could not pass. So it's going to be a difficult thing to pass, but we very much need tort reform because we need to insulate physicians from being second-guessed when they make decisions based on judgment. And there are lots of bad outcomes in medicine because there are lots of things that happen that are beyond the control of the physician. But if he exercises good judgment, he shouldn't spend the next 3 to 7 to 10 years of his life defending a decision he had to make in 30 seconds. The physician that brings the appropriate skill to the task, she should be protected by the system. And she should, and that doesn't just mean that at the end of the day a jury exonerates her. It means that she has protection against being sued. Because it takes a toll on her, and it takes a real toll on her. Sure, people that are patients have terrible outcomes sometimes because they have terrible diseases. But there's another side to the coin. And that side gets way too little attention from people in Washington and from the American public. Again, it's been great being with you. Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.